When a leader commits a great mistake, a great sin, can we still trust him or her? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host for our discussion today. Today we are going to be talking about Uriah, wife of Bathsheba, faith of a foreigner. The conversation partners are two members of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdall. Let's come back to the question that I opened with, and I'd like to put it out for you men to comment on. David committed a great sin, took the wife of Uriah, had Uriah murdered. Could we trust him? Should we trust him when a leader makes a great mistake like that?
I think those kinds of mistakes certainly impact our ability to trust someone. Should we ever fully trust another human being? It seems to me the answer would be no. Can we honor them? Can we see that God can still work through them in spite of their mistakes? Can we support them? Yes. But certainly I would think placing full trust in a human leader is not a wise move.
I think that part of this equation is, what is the nature of the repentance of that leader? Is there such, has this person acknowledged their wrongdoing and repented of it? Or are they trying to buffalo their way along?
You see, in our world today, and I don't, David, you probably would know more about this, but if a man is unfaithful to his marriage vows as a preacher, typically his credentials are removed and he is not allowed ever again to be a preacher. Isn't that technically the policy?
I don't know that's a policy. It's a practice. It may even be a policy, yeah. But that's because I think preachers live in a world of extremely high and open trust that's given them very automatically by people. So if you are unable to manage that trust, what do we do to fix you so that you can?
And that certainly is a key factor when we deal with our majors who are planning to go into ministry. If we see evidence of unfaithfulness to one's promises, that is a very serious matter for us, and we tend not to recommend students who've had that kind of track record. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
True.
But I agree with Paul. I think that if a leader makes a mistake, and you know, was this really a mistake as much as it was a deliberately planned catastrophe? I mean, when you think about what David did, it's
premeditated, calculating.
Yeah.
And then when it goes bad,
yeah,
he just goes even deeper to the point of murder.
Yeah. For those of you who may not be familiar with the story, you may want to read it in 2 Samuel 11. David happens to be out and sees this beautiful woman bathing herself next door. And I suppose we could raise the question, I don't know if the biblical account places any guilt on Bathsheba for what she was doing. Perhaps one would want to be more careful about doing such things and the potential visibility of a king like David. But David invites her over and has sexual relations with her. She tells him she's pregnant. At that point, he asks Uriah to come back. Uriah was out at battle. And he expects Uriah to go to his home, and he refuses. He just sleeps outside, doesn't go back. Twice David tries that. In fact, gets him drunk, but Uriah refuses to go and see his wife. His mates are out there fighting. Why should I go and enjoy things with my wife and in my home? So then David actually sends back with Uriah the message to Joab to see that Uriah be killed. Place him in a vulnerable place and then withdraw help. So, I mean, it was just catastrophic. When he's dead, then he marries Bathsheba as the child. That's the story.
It's a terrible story. Terrible.
It's a story of terrible behavior.
Yeah.
You see, it does cause me to think that sometimes when you're in a fix, you lose sensibleness.
Yeah.
You know, I think David here is kind of just reacting. He's got to get rid of this problem, and everything he tries doesn't work, so he finally gets rid of the Uriah.
And you dig yourself deeper and deeper and deeper with everything that goes. Mm-hmm. Now, knowing what we know about the story, we can say nasty things about David, to be sure. But what can we say about Uriah?
Well, a man of the little bit that we know about him, mm-hmm. He's a valiant warrior, a brave man, with a real strong sense of honor, sort of code of conduct, which we don't know the details of. But when he comes home, as you summarized, he does not make use of all the comforts and privileges of home because his fellow soldiers are out on the battlefield, and so he remains faithful to that mm-hmm. code of conduct mm-hmm. and does not go in and spend time there with his wife. So those little indications along – and in battle, what kills him is he's right at the front. So
now, is he a mercenary? Would we call him a mercenary? He's a Hittite. So, I mean, is he hired by David? I mean, if this is a hired soldier – who's acting like this? This is unbelievable, although his home is right next to yeah. the palace. So
that's hard to say. David had a whole contingent of Philistines, the Gittites, so it's hard to say what the relationship was here.
Mm-hmm. But I agree with Paul. He seems to be a man of honor and integrity mm-hmm. and principle.
Contrasted with David in yeah. this yeah. story.
Right.
And this is what got David in trouble. He ran into a person of integrity.
mm-hmm. That's right. Hmm. Now, there are several other aspects about the story that I would like for us to address. We sometimes have a hard time in our culture, especially where, to use your phrase, Dave, that you used a few weeks ago, serial adultery. We tend to simply gloss that over and not talk about it. One of the amazing things about Uriah, when you get to the story of Jesus' genealogy in Matthew 1, the amazing thing about Jesus' genealogy is there that he mentions four women, all of them notable, but for different reasons. You have Tamar, who committed incest. You have Rahab, who was a prostitute before she joined God's people. You have Ruth, the only good girl in the bunch, who was a Moabite. And instead of mentioning Bathsheba by name, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. This is not David's wife. It is the wife of Uriah the Hittite. It's just astonishing. So in Matthew, he's not afraid to tell the story like it is. But when you go to the book of Chronicles, Chronicles is a retelling of the history of Israel. And scholars have pointed out that probably Samuel Kings, with all the dirt about David and Solomon, was written immediately after the fall of Jerusalem in 586. The author's point was to say even our best kings were scumbags. They were just a mess. I mean, if you read the story of David, it's just catastrophic. So Samuel Kings was probably written to point out that the people were, even the best of us were sinners. That's why Jerusalem was destroyed. Now you come along 150 years later, the time of Chronicles, the people had believed that so much that they lost hope. So the chronicler comes back and gives you the good version, the good news version. And in the good news version of David, not a single one of the sins of David or the sins of Solomon are pointed out. I would like to raise that question in terms of our culture today. Should we cover up? Are there good reasons for doing that, like Chronicles does? Or should we tell the truth, like Samuel Kings? Or does that depend?
It does depend, both. We shouldn't take the Samuel Kings approach. We shouldn't take the Chronicles approach. But depending on the situation and the setting, mm-hmm. I don't think we have to pull out all the dirty laundry all the time. But then there are those occasions where we need to be honest about the sinfulness of even our leaders and mm-hmm. even ourselves. Mm-hmm. But it depends on the time and the place, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. There's seldom anything to be gained by just cataloging evil. Mm-hmm. But I agree with Paul that sometimes it's necessary. But I think there has to be a significant reason for doing that. See, I think of church discipline, for example, where sometimes you have to tell the business of wrongdoing to the church at large. But I think those should be rare occasions. I think there has to be some real purpose to be served.
And the problem is, God is apparently able to cast our sins at the depths of the sea. But once I know a choice morsel about someone, it's virtually impossible for me to forget it. I remember when I took over the dean's office, my predecessor said one of the sadnesses for him, he says, I know things about people I wish I didn't know. See? So when we gratuitously dump out bad news, we make it impossible for other people to think straight, to think clearly. And so I think we ought to be incredibly careful about spreading any kind of the bad news.
Yeah. We're not, though. I think we are more like Samuel and Kings and less like Chronicles. I think we'll share the bad news about people.
But Paul, it's interesting to go to church sometimes and hear the prayers. You can learn a lot about the ailments and woes of people just by hearing the prayers that are prayed in public sometimes.
Their ailments, but not so much about their sins,
I would say.
In fact, if you listen in our Sabbath school classes, the kinds of things people ask for prayer requests for are the easy ones. The really deep hurts, nobody mentions.
Yeah.
Nobody mentions.
Yeah.
One last question here. Why is it that David was not put to death for the sin of adultery?
Because he is the king. I don't know. How do you put the king to death? Who decides that?
It just blew me away when I heard, and I've forgotten when I heard it first, that throughout the entire Old Testament, there is not one illustration of the death penalty meted out for adultery. Not a single instance.
Is that right?
You've got death penalty for picking up sticks on the Sabbath, but for adultery, no. It's almost like, every one of the Ten Commandments has the death penalty in the additional laws except the last one. But it's almost like, if you remember a few years ago, they used to have $10,000 fine for littering. Nobody would ever be brave enough to put out a $10,000 fine for littering, so people just ignored it. But still, the statement of the laws and the death penalty points out the seriousness of the case. But it is fascinating that in the historical accounts, there is no illustration.
The natural consequences of that sin were bad enough.
Oh, just catastrophic. Yeah. David had no control over his family. Now, one last question here. What happens when a foreigner, Uriah the Hittite, is more faithful than God's leader?
Well, my answer to that, it's a embarrassment to God's leader. Whether he recognizes it or not is, of course, the operative question.
So what is our responsibility of those who are supposed to be following the leader?
Well, I like Paul's thing. You should never follow anybody without thought and care.
Follow very cautiously and a couple of steps back.
Yeah.
Well, that's a challenge, and we'll continue to face that challenge as we talk about the rest of our background characters and the Old Testament. Next week, we're going to talk about Abiathar the priest, and that raises some other very challenging questions, which we'll talk about. My thanks to Dave and to Paul for being our conversation partners today, and my thanks also to Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.